Oh, hi. This is Cindy Howes from Basic Folk, and here's what's happening on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Only Vans, a Texas country music pod with rock star host Bree Bagwell, recently welcomed Matt Hillier.
You sang a song nobody had ever heard, and you kept going, come on, everybody, sing it with me.
You know the words.
You know the words. It was the best.
On Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians, myself and co-host Lizzie Noh recently featured John Moreland.
Some of the lyrics are like, you seem to know some things you must have overheard. It sounds like it's talking about a lover. A couple minutes into the song, he's talking about a smartphone, and it just creeped me out so hard that I got a flip phone too.
Oh, wow. And finally, the String Dusters' Travis Book is hosting the Travis Book Happy Hour, live music and conversation from guests like Trey Hensley.
Just listening to Earl Scruggs play the banjo or play the guitar, you always knew it was him. There was always those people that played, and you immediately, within a few seconds of hearing their instrument, knew it was them.
Hear it all and more on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts. This podcast is sponsored by North Carolina's premier bluegrass celebration, Earl Scruggs Music Festival, returning to Mill Spring, North Carolina this Labor Day weekend at the breathtaking Tryon International Equestrian Center. Artists include Tanya Tucker, Marty Stewart and his Fabulous Superlatives, Old Crow Medicine Show, Yonder Mountain String Band, and more. Help us celebrate the life of Earl Scruggs and his incredible contributions to music and culture from August 30th to September 1st. Passes and lodging are available at earlscruggsmusicfest.com.
Cindy, we have so much to talk about.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that you are on vacay, you have your swimsuit on, and you're ready to hop in the hot tub.
That's right.
I am on tour. I am staying in a hotel with my wonderful guitar player, Will Green, and we are sleeping on twin beds.
I think you popped the mic on your twin bed.
Damn it.
Just say, we're staying in twin beds, but say it gently.
We're staying in twin beds.
Lizzie Noh has set the scene, and I would love to welcome you to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. It's Cindy and Lizzie. We are here to do this podcast. Also, we would like for you to sign up for our monthly newsletter. You can do so at the link in the show notes or at basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media. We're on four platforms.
Four?
Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. Follow us there. You can also help us out, make a contribution, a financial donation.
Make a contribution. Do it. I just announced on air that I sleep on a twin bed when I'm on tour. This is a real working woman's operation, and we would love your contributions so that we can continue making this cool-ass show.
Yeah, I just want you to know that any contributions made to Basic Folk do not go towards bed funding. It goes towards pod funding.
Cindy, how's your summer going? It feels like I'm having my summer abroad. I'm making new friends. I'm learning the language.
Oh, yes, of abroad in the United Kingdom.
Yes. I'm saying things like, that's a good shout. Nice one. In it.
Are you calling the trash can the bin?
The bin. Yeah, put that in the bin. You know what I will just never do, though? I will never say, I need to pop to the loo. That seems childish. I'm sorry to any British listeners that might be listening.
It's half childish and half sexual.
That's the thing about British people, I feel.
Hit the nail on the head. Lizzie, my summer is going just great. We went to the Howes family reunion recently.
How is everybody?
Everybody is doing great. My dad, or I think my mom, was telling people that Elizabeth is a geriatric doctor. Most of the people I'm related to are named Betsy, and they're all awesome. If any of the Betsys are listening,
shout out to Betsy.
Lovely to see the Betsys. Also, Hootie got to see our family cabin in Western Mass for the first time ever.
That's gorgeous.
It is on a 1-acre plot of land in the middle of the woods. There are literally no neighbors. There is no running water. There is no electricity. There's an outhouse. My brother and my dad have worked really hard on maintaining the cabin, which is called the bungalow. And Elizabeth saw it for the first time, and she's like, tell your brother if he ever wants any help on any of these projects, I'm in. And they're like projects that are like, let's make sure the house doesn't fall over. And they take like a year to complete.
The stakes are high, and I know Hootie's up to the task. If there's one thing I know in this life, it's I would call on Hootie for a task like that.
Oh, yeah. You know how like people who use tools have like a favorite brand of tools that are all the same color? So she has like a favorite brand of tools. It's the highlighter yellow one.
Oh, my gosh. And on the next episode, we'll be dropping the brand name. So stay tuned for this cliffhanger. Which brand of tools does Cindy's wife use?
Maybe in the time between, we can get a sponsorship.
Let's do that. Oh, wait. Speaking of Western Massachusetts, I failed to mention I am on tour with one of the most delightful bands of all time. And many of them are from Western Massachusetts.
Mm.
They're called Darlingside. Guys, do you know Darlingside? You have to be listening to Darlingside if you like this podcast. When you hear them singing all together, you feel like you're just like around a campfire. It feels so nice to listen to them sing.
It's like a campfire in heaven.
A campfire in heaven.
Yeah.
Should we talk about our guest?
Yes.
Okay. If I feel like the sparkle filter, if the sparkle filter became a person, it might be Denisha. Denisha is so special. When I was thinking about how to introduce Denisha, I'm trying to communicate what I find so special about her. I think what I feel the most strongly about is how special her mind is. Sometimes it strikes me just how much power can emanate from a curious mind if you allow your mind to remain open and insightful and investigative. And speaking with Denisha was one of those moments for me. When she comes across an unfamiliar musical concept, she goes, quote unquote, sponge mode until she understands it. She soaks up everything she can about the new topic, and then she seamlessly integrates it into her artistic vocabulary. So this relentless curiosity and sense of play can be heard all across Denisha's catalog, all the way back from her early work as half of the New York indie R&B duo Denisha and Scene, to her breakthrough country album, Highways. Her fluency with multiple genres gives her a refreshing approach to record making, sound, and fashion alike. We had to get into all of these topics in the interview. Don't worry, I asked her all about her wardrobe. So since moving to Nashville and pivoting from R&B to indie country, Denisha has been grabbing audiences' attention with her gorgeous voice and catchy as hell, cool girl indie songwriting. Denisha was selected for the CMT Next Women of Country class of 2024, and her forthcoming album, Sunset Drive, delivers on the hype and then some. She and her longtime songwriting partner, Brad Allen Williams, have painted classic country landscapes against which tales of escape from the ordinary are told with longing and warmth. The new record is something of a full circle moment for the Texas-born artist, and it's also a showcase for her prodigious talents as a vocalist.
Her co-writer, Brad Allen Williams, that is such a country songwriter name. David Allen Coe, Jerry Jeff Walker, Amy
Brad
Lou
Allen
Harris.
Williams.
Yep.
And it's sort of like three first names. you could shake them up.
Yep. All right, let's take a listen to Denisha's song, Back to You, and then we'll get to our conversation with Lizzie Ngo and Denisha on Basic Folk.
Spring will take me right on into summer.
Denisha, welcome to Basic Folk. I am Lizzie Ngo. I am the co-host, guest host, occasional rogue host, and I couldn't be more excited to be talking with you about your new album.
Thank you. It's so good to be here and awesome to finally meet you.
I feel the same way. I've been lurking on the internet. I've been lurking on Instagram for a while, like, who is this person? I need to know all about their music. Where are you right now? Do you have like a little home studio? I feel like I see very cute sound isolation materials on the wall.
Oh, yes. I am in my home studio here in Nashville. and this is my music room where songs get written and whatnot.
It's cute as hell. I want to start our interview not with talking about your music, but talking about your other identity, which is a nerdy smart kid. So growing up, you were very advanced academically. Your family encouraged you to pursue higher learning. But after graduating from the prestigious Vanderbilt University, you started pursuing your career as a singer-songwriter. Mm. Woo! Now, I'm sure some of our listeners can relate. Like, it took some convincing to convince your loved ones that you really were on the right path. And they're now very supportive. But it seems like it's one thing to bring your loved ones on board, and it's another thing to kind of convince yourself that you're like definitely making the right choices with your life. So were there times when you really had to like convince yourself, this is the right path for me? And were there habits or tendencies that you had as like a straight A, do all the homework kid that you had to unlearn so that you could become the artist that you are now?
Wow. Yes. What a great set of questions. And where did you get all this information is going to be my next question for you, following.
Like I said, I've been lurking.
Right. Sure. Yeah. After I graduated from Vanderbilt with a degree in art history, I did consider going into that field, and I worked in a couple of art galleries, and I was kind of exploring my options there, but I kind of got the singer-songwriter bug in high school, like pretty early on. Mm-hmm. So after I graduated, by then I had already played in the coffee shops around Nashville during college. I had done a bunch of open mics, and there was something there that I couldn't turn off. I just had to find out what being an artist was all about. But it had its challenges at first because, like you said, I had been on this track since I was like 2 years old to be like an advanced student, to pursue academic excellence. And I commend my mom for her commitment to that in me and for my family's support. Like my family really poured into that part of me and mm-hmm. did everything they could to help me to achieve what I did achieve academically. But because I had kind of been on that track from 2 to 16 when I graduated high school, going to college and starting to form my own identity and form my own idea of what I wanted to be when I grew up, it became hard when I graduated college because then I sort of started over. Even though I had invested all this time and all these years into formal education, deciding to pursue being a singer-songwriter and an artist was difficult because I kind of got on the ground floor of this whole other building when I was on the 10th floor of a different building, you know? So I was working in...
I hear that loud and clear.
You know what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. And working in the coffee shops and doing a lot of like service industry jobs. For one, growing up, you know, my mom always taught me, and I observed this in my parents and my family, that any job that you do has value and honor and integrity. I was glad that I was instilled with that because I've worked a lot of service industry jobs so that I could have the flexibility to place shows, to write, to tour. And I would interact with people that I went to school with. I would interact with my professors from Vanderbilt. And it was tough. Mm-hmm. It made me like face myself and to try to understand, like, is this really what I want to do? Because this is hard. And like, I'm dealing with all this like self-esteem, all these self-esteem issues. And so it took a while for me to shift out of that gear. But I feel like I'm better for it. I feel like I'm better for having wrestled with that early on.
100%. You know, the kind of the coffee shop service industry thing really resonates with me because I had a similar experience of like, you work so hard from kindergarten and even before you go to the fancy college. And then to be an artist, you know, unless you have a trust fund, it's going to be waiting tables or nannying or whatever the service industry job is. And one thing that I feel like I learned really early on in those jobs was that, like, it's one thing to be like a really promising student, and it's another thing to be a Black woman in a service job where nobody knows or cares what you've accomplished. I wonder if you had any experiences like that, that you'd be willing to speak to, of like seeing yourself in a new light through people's eyes once you ended up in service roles.
Well, it was, I feel fortunate that I've been immersed in all these different worlds. I've been immersed in upper class culture at my prestigious university. Growing up, we were, you know, middle class. I went to school with working class kids. We were working class. It was, so I've been in that world. And then going into the service industry, that's working class, man. I'm like making friends with the dishwasher. I washed dishes for a time because I just like needed a gig. And I feel like I've just seen and known people and loved people in all these different walks of life. And it's really informed the lens of my art and my songwriting. And it's informed kind of my why I do this. And it's to connect with people. And it's because I believe that songs transcend class. Music transcends where people are coming from, and it brings us together to with this like convergence of like human stories and like all of these experiences that we share across like economics, identity, nationality.
Getting into kind of like your musical roots, I've read that your earliest performance opportunities were in church. And you've said that that context gave you this sense that music is about us, not me. And it also gave you a sense that there was a powerful spirituality to be found in music. So how does this sense of the collective, this sense of the spiritual show up for you in your music now that you're a solo artist, now that you're not performing in that context? You're kind of like out on your own. You're not performing primarily in church.
Right. I do have to say that your level of journalism is unmatched, and I've done a ton of press, and like you just like knowing and picking up all these things is really cool. And thank you for that. It makes for a really cool conversation.
No, thank you for sitting with me, because I'm very curious about your work, and like, that's what we do here.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I like to kind of say that my first times on stage were in church, because leading like praise and worship at my Christian high school, you know, we would have chapel on Wednesday. I think it was in the middle of the day. And those were my first opportunities to be on stage and like playing guitar and singing. And it didn't feel like a performance. It felt like we were gathered for something that was bigger than me, bigger than you, bigger than everyone. And that has also really informed the way that I look at music, is that it has this quality of taking us outside of ourselves to see ourselves, and like to put up a mirror to like who we are. But also there's so much empathy that can be like created and generated in that space. And yeah, it was really valuable. And I think I bring that to my performances now, because it's not really about me. I love writing songs, and I love to sing, and I love the art of discovering a song as I'm writing it. And I love to perform because I enjoy connecting with people, and I enjoy the uniqueness of the moment of a show. I was just playing this show last week, and I brought that up, and I bring it up a lot. It's like, this is so cool because this moment will never happen again. Like, I might get up and play these songs in a different city on a different stage, but the energy of the specific people that are in the room, what everybody's feeling, what everybody brought into that room is unique. And that is the magic of music for me.
Yeah, that's actually like, it feels like that's actually what's really special about any spiritual gathering as well. Like, it's actually just about that particular moment, those particular people, those particular feelings. I want to talk about your R&B duo, Denisha and Scene. You made waves as an R&B artist long before you popped off as a country singer-songwriter. And it kind of puts you in this unique position of being a true crossover artist. So I'm curious to hear your perspective on the two genres and like, can you think of something that you feel like R&B artists are doing really, really well right now that you wish would cross over into country or vice versa? Mm-hmm. Like if you could give advice, like, here's what you don't know about what's going on in R&B that we should be doing over here in country and folk.
I was actually just thinking about that this morning. And I was thinking about how my focus musically has really shifted from 10 years ago to now. 10-ish years ago is when I started to discover music and audio production and like making sounds and like where sounds come from and like making electronic music. And that is what kind of led me into that R&B electronic space. And there is something very sonic focused about that space. It's about the samples. It's about how cool the sounds are, the 808, and like it's about creating these like soundscapes. And it's not always focused on traditional songwriting. It's about like, yo, like that sample's hard, like that sounds crazy, or like how'd you get your snare to sound like that? And I think like coming into the Americana and country space, where now my focus has shifted back to just great songwriting, and that's what's really like bringing me in and like making me fans of the people that are around. I think that some of that, it would be cool to hear some of the focus on sound and production kind of like get brought into some of the Americana space, because in R&B and pop, like there is this sort of idea about like pushing boundaries and like pushing forward, and also like being in the zeitgeist, like what sounds cool right now, and like how can we also get a song to sound like that? And it would be interesting to hear that get explored in this space too.
Everything that you're talking about is what, with regard to sound, like being an audiophile and also being someone that really, really gets the fundamentals of like roots songwriting, I feel like knocked out of the park on your new album. Mm. I love the new album, Sunset Drive. And before we kind of get into particular tracks, I want to talk about one of the most important relationships behind the album, your friendship with your co-writer, Brad Allen Williams. Can you tell me a little bit about your friendship? And then more specifically, like, what did working with him teach you about yourself as a songwriter, as a producer, et cetera?
Oh, yeah, it's so cool. I mean, Brad and I, we're in touch all the time. We're just sitting here over here before I got on this call, like texting about Vince Gill songs from the 90s. You know, like we just have a shorthand and a kind of a world that we've built and that we like speak together within. Brad and I started working together, like we started making records back in like 2011 when I first moved to New York. Yeah, when I first moved to New York. You're in New York, right?
I'm in Dublin right now, but I live in Nashville. I just moved to Nashville.
What?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Oh, that's... I am on the journey.
Oh, okay. Another thing to touch base offline about. That's so cool.
Yeah, that was why it was like a little tricky scheduling. God bless Michelle Steele. We love Michelle. She's my publicist as well.
Yes, she's a badass. Okay.
Missing piece for the win. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, back to Brad. All day, bro. Like all day. So Brad and I met in New York through mutual friends, like when I first moved to New York City in 2010-ish. And then we started making recordings back then. I just like, ever since I got into music, I've always just wanted to be surrounded by people who are more knowledgeable than me better players. Mm. Like, I just heard somebody say that one time and I was like, oh yeah. Like, I think there's a level of intelligence that I really value that is knowing when you don't know something, because you know what it feels like to know mm-hmm. something. So you know when you don't know, and then you're like, I go into sponge mode. Like, I'm in very curious mode, yeah. asking a lot of questions. And Brad is somebody who is so knowledgeable about engineering, production, and he's just an unbelievable guitar player. And he spends a lot of time thinking about the craft. And we really bonded on that. I was just passionate about writing songs and making things that sounded beautiful. And we just really, we overlapped in a way that was really special. And we made cool. an EP together. We just recorded a couple of songs live back in like 2011. And then we tried to get some other projects started up. We made another EP in 16, and we were writing songs together. And then in 2020, in the quarantine, when I was like, man, like, I just want to make country music. And I'd been threatening to do so for a while. I would write these songs with, you know, I would write these songs and go over to Brad's, and I would write these songs, and he'd be like, man, that is a country song. And then we'd go on these tangents about 80s and 90s country that we listened to when we were mm-hmm. growing up. And in 2020, when we started making Highways, it just came from he and I being friends and texting about, like, how you doing over there in the quarantine? What are you up to? And like, I was like, man, I've really been just obsessing over country music. And like, should we just make that one song that we wrote? We know it's country. Should we make it that way? And then we did. And he tracked all the instruments and everything at his place. And we loved how it.
You tracked that whole EP remotely?
We tracked all of Highways without being in the same room, in that Brad played wow. all of the instruments. He mixed it all. And when we did the vocals, we were together, but he was in the control room and I was in the mm-hmm. vocal booth.
I've done versions of this, but it's always so much trickier that I feel than you think it's going to be when you get started. So you were writing songs together, but how did you like communicate the character, the tempos, like the arrangements that you wanted him to execute, like without being in the room?
Totally. So
were you just sending drafts back and forth and back and forth?
In a way, most of the songs on Highways were a result of, I was working on a song and then Brad and I would get on FaceTime and I'd be like, well, here's what I've got. Like, what do you think? And then we'd finish the song together. We'd make a work tape.
Oh yeah. Right, okay. So you'd be playing acoustic guitar on FaceTime.
Oh yeah.
God bless your internet connection. Sorry to dig down so deep into this, but I think that like this part of recording is like so fascinating to me. Like, how do you actually download what's going on in your songwriter brain to mm-hmm. someone who's then going to like arrange, produce? Like, it's such an interesting dynamic to me.
Yeah, it is. And like, you know, we get on FaceTime and we wrote Sunset Drive that way too, all remotely. And mm-hmm. we just write over FaceTime, and then either he'll make a work tape at the end of the session or I'll make one. But for Highways, we spent a lot of time talking and listening to different references about how I had a lot of ideas about how I wanted this to feel, how I wanted it to come mm-hmm. across. And then he started introducing like Glen Campbell. I had never listened to Glen Campbell before, mm-hmm. but I had no idea that that was where my head was at. Right. And so
yeah.
we were just exchanging all of these ideas, and we talk so much about the vision before we start even recording. And I'll kind of like play the demo. We'll talk about what the tempo should feel like. And he'll lay down like some initial tracks and be like, this is where it's going. And then I'll be like, great, sounds good. And then he spends, you know, a day just building that track by himself. He's honestly so brilliant, and we have such a trusting working relationship that it's just made mm-hmm. for a really special collaboration.
So cool. I've been going back and forth. What's my favorite song on Sunset Drive? Right now, I'm really, really into Wild Light. And there's something about that song that's just like instantly classic. I have found that like really delicate, spare, like catchy, memorable songs like that are often like deceptively the most complex to produce because you don't want to put too much shit in there, right? Like you want to keep the melody. You want to make sure the vocal really stands out. Can you talk a little bit about how that song came to be? Like, did it start with the piano melody? Did it start with a lyric? How did you and Brad find your way into that final arrangement that's like kind of surprising and delicate and spare?
Yeah, that's really cool. And I'm glad you like that song. Thank you. And it's interesting that you said that because that is probably the fourth life that song has lived. It started off.
Really?
Yes. It started off as a song that I like made a basic production of, and I was working on this alias project where I called it my middle name, Adeswa. And I've actually got an EP and maybe another single out on that project that Brad and I worked on together. And I had that song, Wild Light.
A secret EP? But this is where I failed in my journalism because you have a secret side project I've never even heard of. Drop Most the links.
Most people haven't. It's just kind of over there in the cut, like in the underground, but it's out there to be listened to. So the first time that we released it, Brad produced it and had some kind of like electronic drums on it, and there were synths, and it was like kind of this larger kind of deal. And then we did an acoustic version of it where it was like acoustic guitar and piano. And then that was in like 2016. And as we were working on Sunset Drive, that was a song where I can't remember if it was Brad or me that brought it up, but it's like Wild Light, like, it still hasn't gotten its day. Like, let's bring it back and do something tender with it. And Brad had the idea to put a string quartet on it and wrote out an arrangement for it. And I went out to LA to do a bunch of vocals, and he got the string section together, and he played, you know, tracked the piano in Brooklyn. We got together in LA, got the strings and got the vocals, and we pieced it together in this way. And I'm really happy with how it turned out. There used to be background vocals on that song. It used to be, we thought it was telling us to be like big and epic. And I think that song just really wants to be tender and minimal.
I want to talk about love songs because you really excel in this area. And like, I myself am a songwriter, and that's like the hardest like writing assignment for me is write a love song. Like what I want to do is, you know, observe relationships from an ironic distance or think about like an idealized version of love that's never going to really happen, or like, you know, all of these barriers in the way of the earnest, heart on your sleeve thing. And I know a lot of our listeners are songwriters themselves. So I wonder if you have any advice for getting to that place, where you're earnest, where you're optimistic, like what you achieve on Ready to Fall. Like that's such a great heart on your sleeve love song to me. How do you get there emotionally to where you're able to write in that mode?
Right. Well, I will say that the way that you write and the subjects that you write about is, I love that about what you do, is that it doesn't feel, it feels atypical and like you don't know what to expect, like from where you're taking us as the listener. And so I think that's really cool about what you do as an artist.
Okay, thank you. I guess it's like a grass is greener moment. We always wish we could do the thing that we're like not currently doing.
Yeah, for sure. And then like you said, like you mentioned the term like writing assignment, and it's like those kinds of things, there's always room for that to be like, all right, I'm going to actually try to do this thing that I don't normally do. And Ready to Fall, whether it seems like it or not, was actually a push for me, because I live in a really bittersweet place. There's like always a thread of melancholy in my writing and in my kind of lens. And when Brad and I were working on Ready to Fall, it was a push for me to keep it like, no, let's make this like a straightforward song that has one meaning and no other implications. It's just about falling in love. And I think that that one was actually kind of unusual for me in that way.
How did you keep yourself in that place? Were there moments where you were like, oh, I want to bring in the, you know, dark cloud? Like, did you have to rein yourself back in?
Yeah, totally. I found ways. I feel like I found ways to find the realism in it, like in like the production, kind of like it was very, for me, I was like, I want to see like what would happen if like, if The Cure like made like a country song and it was almost like came from like The Replacements, but also was like Randy Travis. And like, that's where we kind of like came from with that song. And I was like, as long as it feels
like to a T.
Oh, okay. Good. I'm glad. I was like, as long as it feels kind of British, then I think that like there's a cloud out here. And I think that just having that post-punk kind of bass, like kind of grounded me in like, you know, all right, there's still like a little bit of edge in here. But I think I just like, I've just focused on this one feeling. I just narrowed my lens. I decided to just be like, okay, let's narrow the lens and just look at this snapshot of a moment where you just feel like, oh, this is it. I finally arrived. And like, this is the love that I've been waiting for. And just that snapshot, not the snapshot of the moment after where you're like, oh, but should I do it? And like, I don't know. And then the last person, like, they really hurt me, or like anything else. It was just about like going in like super granular on that one moment where you just feel bliss.
Focus. You brought up something that made me want to ask another sneaky, snoopy question, which is that I've heard a rumor that you were an emo kid growing up. Can you confirm or deny these allegations? And are there emo and or, like you said, post-punk influences on Sunset Drive? Like, where would we see that showing up?
That is so funny. Well, I'll be somewhat honest, and like when I was a kid, we didn't have emo. We had grunge. We had post grunge and we had alternative rock. Like when I was little and growing up out in this town called Dayton, about an hour outside of Houston, where my parents, much to my chagrin at the time, moved us out to the woods. And we lived in this double wide trailer, and their room was on one end of it and my room was on the other end. And I had a TV antenna. I'm aging myself all over the place. I had a TV antenna and I had my guitar, and I would just like sing Alanis Morissette songs with the TV antenna as my microphone, you know, when I was,
oh my God, hell yeah.
You know what I mean? And when I was in middle school, I was little, but I would write the band Bush, like all over my notebooks. Like I loved Bush. I thought they were so cool. And Stone Temple Pilots were on a poster up in my wall. You know, I was a big Nirvana, especially the Nirvana Unplugged album. And so when I was very little, I was obsessed with country music, and I listened to country music and I listened to Christian music. And that was a little bit by design, because we were Christian people. And my parents, my mom specifically, she allowed me to listen to country music. She allowed me to listen to Christian music. Then when I was about 13, she allowed me to turn the dial to more secular stations. And that's when I was just immediately drawn to alternative music. So to answer your question, I'll never beat those allegations. I definitely walked around with my shoulders shrugged. I begged my mom to buy me corduroy everything. And in eighth grade, I was just so like Daria coded.
I love Daria. Today's kids need Daria, actually, I think. I read an interview with you on Bandcamp Daily, where you were talking about how on Waiting, you said, "I was thinking about humans and how some of us have things and some of us don't. It's about this innate need to move forward, to do more, to keep chasing that carrot. We all deal with that except for monks. They have it figured out." So years later, thinking about Sunset Drive, what role does desire play in your songwriting now?
Wow. Okay. All right.
We're here.
Wow. You took me a lot of places, Lizzie. What role does desire?
Yeah. It's all in the historical record.
I know, but it's deep. I think that Sunset Drive is this picture of a series of moments where I desire more. I desire more from life. I desire more from my romantic life, from my positioning in this world. But then at the same time, I'm wrestling with making do with what I have. But also having this sort of eye towards how to make it better and how to have a better mm-hmm. life. So there's this element of knowing that there's a new chapter ahead and it's time for me to step into it, but also relishing in the comfort of just being in a place that feels predictable, but knowing that I can't stay in that place for long. So mm-hmm. I'm not a monk, and I do, as a person, I am like subject to my desire to grow constantly and to evolve constantly. And sometimes that's at odds with my desire to stay in one place, man, just mm-hmm. be comfortable, set up a nice life and just do the one thing. But alas, I'm not really built like that. And I do long for just constant evolution.
Thanks for going there. I don't want to not address your voice. It's this thing that a lot of people try to describe, and it's really impossible to describe. And I have, it's like sort of like a main character on your album. I'm curious how, in terms of like big picture producing the album, how did you make sure that your voice remained the star of the show, in spite of having these like really full bodied arrangements? And like, it's a really like dense album with a ton going on, but your voice, which is like kind of gentle and like, it has a really like straight tone. How did you make sure that your voice was coming through no matter what? Were there moments where you had to kind of dial back some of the arrangement choices on the record?
Yeah, I think there's this constant like pursuit of like a certain type of sound or a blending of sounds. And then always having to check the main focus, which is making sure the vocal's coming through and making sure the song is clear mm-hmm. and that the song is cutting through. So it's like that, the vocal being out front is what is always like guiding us in terms of like the way that Brad and I work. And going into this album, we talked a lot before we even started recorded note one, you know, and part of the vision was like, no matter what we do, like, let's make sure that vocal is out front. We figured out a lot on highways in terms of what mics work best, what setups work best, mm-hmm. and like constantly just figuring out where to take my voice. And I think I kind of challenged myself a little bit on Sunset Drive in terms of how high, how low, where some more mm-hmm. emotion could be mined in different parts of my voice. And so that was definitely a main focal point for us and for me going into this record, is like, no matter what, like, I know for a fact now, coming out of Highways, like, and coming out of, you know, all the other projects I've ever done, is people are connecting with something in my voice. And so that is my main thing that I can continue to use to engage and connect with people. And let's not miss out on that opportunity.
Do you have a vocal warm-up that you do on the road? Do you have like particular superstitions or rituals that you like keeping your voice in shape?
Yeah. Al Green is a big warm-up for me. I just throw on Al Green records that I know, and I just sing them. And I just sing full. I try to just work up to a full voice and go with him from the lows up to the falsetto. And that's always a good, like, clutch warm-up for me. One thing that I have learned over the years is, like, when it's time to sing, like, don't start warming up, like, 30 minutes before it's time to hit stage. Like, you got to ramp yourself up. You don't want to, like, I don't want to blow my throat out. I don't want to blow the actual physical components of my voice out. It's like any other thing. Like, when I was an athlete in high school, you've got to, like, you don't just jump out on the basketball court and start playing. You have to, like, warm your muscles up and be kind to your body and to your instrument. So whenever I can, the one thing that I really love to do is sneak out for, like, a quick walk right before I play. Like, if I'm in the green room, I just try to, like, figure out, like, how can I just, like, go outside and just kind of sing to myself and take a little walk around the block. So that's, like, a big part of my ritual.
Participated in the Black Opry's residency in collaboration with WXPN.
Yes.
Can you talk about what that experience was like and any lessons that you learned about, like, the resources and support it takes to help emerging artists?
The residency was so cool and so special, and I will always value, like, the bond that it created amongst all the artists. There are, like, five of us. And yeah, that residency was a real blessing. I just moved to Nashville, and a few months later I got into that residency, and a lot of us in that program were at different levels and in different parts of our career. We have different goals, but the actual program was about, I think it was like 10 weeks of weekly Zoom meetings with different people who are experts in their field and whatever they do in music, right? Booking, publishing, managing, songwriting. And we would just get on these Zooms with folks, and they would just talk about their experience, give any, like, advice that they had, answer a bunch of questions. It's just cool to, like, interface with folks, hear what other artists are thinking about. And it does make you realize that artist development is a massive, massive lift. It is not a one key fits all kind of situation. I think that, and I've been talking about this a lot lately, I think the music industry, and probably a lot of other areas, it's one that you really need to have a sponge-like curiosity in order to collect such a wide array of information that might apply to what you want to do. And it's also probably even more important to have something of a vision of how you want it to go down. Whether that vision works out or not, you need to have some kind of a path that you see for yourself, and maybe kind of look around to other artists who have done what you want to do, and then just figure out how to emulate. So yeah, it's being a music, an independent music artist in this year, 2024, is not a joke. It's not for the birds. It's not.
You can say that again.
It's not.
Oh my God.
For...
Oh my God. We need to get a drink when I'm back in Nashville.
Can we please? It is. Everything's changing every day. It's not a get rich quick scheme. It's none of that. I think that's also why I really value and talk a lot about like really focusing in on why. Why do I want to do this work? Because if I don't have a really great reason, I should do something else because it's not easy and it takes up a lot of time. And it takes a lot of hard work and like consistency to keep it going.
Okay. I'm dying to ask, and I know that this might be too big of a question to answer like at the tail end of a podcast. Okay. So we can narrow in, like, not even talking about your whole career, but talking about you today, here and now. As far as your artistic vision right now, what is your why?
My why is to make music that I love, that moves people while being as authentically myself as I possibly can.
Boom. I take back what I said. It was not too complicated for you. Denisha, you are a visionary and you easily tackled that big question. Okay, I just have one more question and then I want to do a lightning round with you. We need to talk about your like sort of iconic fashion sense. Are there particular colors and silhouettes that you're drawn to as a performer? And is there a distinction between your fashion as yourself, Denisha, human person, versus Denisha on stage?
That's cool. I've always had fun with clothes. Even when I was little, and my mom could always dress. And like when I was growing up, we loved to shop and we loved to like just get our look like dialed in, you know? And as like an artist, like I've gone through different phases, like, you know, back when I was doing more of a pop R&B thing, it was very like streetwear inspired. And like, I had like just so many pairs of sneakers and like, it was about New York streetwear. And in the last like 4 or 5 years, it's kind of taken me a minute to figure out how I want to look and feel and present. And I met this incredible stylist in Nashville. Her name is Star Hawks. And we met and she just looked at me and she was like, oh, I get it. Because I've worked with a lot of stylists and a lot of fashion people and they want to try to make something else out of me. And it's like, I can only be me, man. Like, let's not do this. Like, it's not going to work out. It's going to be frustrating, you know? And so the way that I like to feel is I like a lot of vintage clothes. I like thrifting. I like vintage secondhand clothes. I like clothes that have been lived in and have a story. The silhouettes that I really enjoy are 70s inspired and kind of a vintage Western kind of thing. When I'm putting a look together, like, even if I bought like some new pants that are new, I try to make sure that there's something more old stuff on me than there is new stuff, because it feels more lived in and real. And like, I like things that have stood the test of time. And what Star and I have really honed in on in our kind of like pursuit of this look is like, we're inspired by classic Lenny Kravitz silhouettes.
Yes.
You know, just like, and I like to just throw like a lot of big collars on, you know, and just lots of chains and flared out pants. And I've got a lot of boots that I really enjoy wearing. And I have two just super nice ostrich skin cowboy boots that I inherited from my grandfather. That I break out for special occasions. He was a shorter man. And so and I have big feet. So somewhere in the middle, mm-hmm. we like wore the same size shoe. And so I have a bunch of his shoes. So I really enjoy getting dressed these days, especially because we've really like come up with a style that feels like me and feels like it expresses what I'm trying to convey musically, which is like effortless and down to earth, but like dressed mm-hmm. for the occasion.
I love that classic Lenny Kravitz style, filling pop shoes. It's really good. Okay. I have a few lightning round questions. Don't think too hard.
Okay.
First instinct.
All right.
Okay. You're back in Brooklyn. You're at the bodega. What's your order?
Oh, egg and cheese, salt, pepper, ketchup on a roll.
Drink?
I don't drink coffee anymore, but I would drink a deli coffee right now.
A deli coffee with 4 inches of napkins on top?
Yeah, and those little Greek-style blue cups and the little white plastic top and just all the napkins you could stand. And if you don't have the second to stop them before they do this, that cup is going with all the napkins. It's going in a small paper bag, and that paper bag's going in a black plastic bag. It's like, Lord have mercy, we don't need all that. All right.
Trash flotilla for breakfast. Okay, what is the best time of day to write a song?
Morning, without a doubt. With the shortest bridge from the dream state to the piece of paper.
100%. Okay, who is your celebrity crush?
Rihanna.
Who is your favorite songwriter in Nashville right now?
Oh, Ashley McBride.
Mm-hmm. What is your biggest pet peeve?
When people don't go from the bottom up on the toothpaste, just squeezing it all psychotically.
Oh my God. Gross. what is one R&B song you wish you had written?
Good Days, SZA.
Oh yeah. Who is one Houston area artist you think everybody should listen to at least once?
Jeez, that's so hard. I'm sorry. This is supposed to be lightning. Robert Glasper.
It's okay. Oh, great. Done. And finally, if you became president tomorrow, what would be your first act as chief executive?
Taxing the rich.
Let's go, Denisha. Let's go. Okay. Thank you so much for being my guest on Basic Folk. This has been such a treat, and I am like, I can't wait for our audience to hear Sunset Drive. It's a gorgeous album. You're such a cool artist.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and this has been a great conversation.
This episode was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can look for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can check us out on FolkAlley.com and Folk Alley's mobile app. You can go to our website, basicfolk.com, or listen wherever you get podcasts.
You need to share this episode with anyone in your life who is from Texas, is currently in the state of Texas, or is interested generally in the state of Texas. Share it with a Texan, y'all.
Send it to Sandy Cheeks from SpongeBob SquarePants.
Sandy would love Denisha. I'm getting over eating all the acorns living underneath the sea.
Yes. This is what I'm talking about. All right. We'll see you next time. We love you so much.
Goodbye. We love you. Bye. Bye. Bye.